This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello. Why is there not a four on the countdown, Kieran? It goes 5-3. It confuses me every time. Hello and welcome to The Price of Football. They'll take that bit out. The show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, how are you this Saturday morning? We're doing it Saturday morning because you're off on a little jaunt to my favourite country, aren't you?
That's right. I'm back to Belgium. I was in Antwerp a few weeks ago, and now I'm going to fit in Brussels and Bruges. And I might, if I'm allowed, buy myself the Belgian away shirt, the Tintin-like shirt, because it's just so cool.
We are going to be talking about that shirt on Thursday's news pod. We're supposed to be talking about the England shirt, Kieran, but we'll spend more time talking about that Tintin Belgium away shirt, because that is... I'm not like you, Kieran. I don't rush out to buy shirts. I'm buying that bugger. That's a cracker. Have a lovely time in Brussels and Bruges, Kieran. Bruges is the most beautiful city, but you need to be up at 7 o'clock in the morning before the Americans get out of bed so you can see it properly. It's questions day today, Kieran, but we have a massive news story to start, although appropriately I have a lot of questions about the massive news story. And it's Leicester being charged by the Premier League and their, I think we could say, robust response, threatening legal action. I'm going to be honest about this, Kieran. I've got a handle on the Everton case. I've got a handle on the Forest case. I'm slightly baffled by what's going on with this one, Kieran. So I will have questions. But if you could perhaps talk us through the initial events of this week vis-a-vis Leicester City in the Premier League.
Yes, we know that a couple of weeks ago, Leicester City successfully defended themselves in the case of charges brought by the EFL that Leicester should be subject to a business plan, which would potentially force them to have sold some players in the January window, for example, on the grounds that they were not an EFL club on a particular date. We then have had, in the last 7 days, the Premier League saying, well, we're going to put you up on a charge. And this all happened within the space of a couple of hours. We're going to put you up on a charge, A, for breaching the Premier League PSR limit of £105 million over 3 years for the year ended the 30th of June 2023. And then it also appeared to say, we're also going to put you up on a charge for not sending us your accounts by the 31st of December, because that's part of the Premier League rules. And I'm going, well, hold on. Leicester City weren't in the Premier League on the 31st of December. So that seemed a bit strange. So we've got that issue to deal with. At the same time, at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, the EFL said, we're imposing a transfer embargo on Leicester City Football Club. And this seems a strange thing to do on the 22nd of March, but it will carry on and it will have potential impact, I guess, on Leicester City going forwards for, once again, a breach of PSR rules. And why were they able to do that? Well, under the EFL rules, you have to submit your accounts to that body by the 1st of March, unlike the Premier League, which is the 31st of December. And here we've got another prime example of having two governing and conflicting boards within football creates inconsistency. And if clubs are in that transitional phase between the Premier League and the EFL, which set of rules do they have to apply with? Is it both? Is it one? Is it neither? So that certainly didn't help. And then,
can I just stop you there? While this thought's in my head, will the EFL and the Premier League have been consulting with each other about these charges, or will they have been acting completely ignorant to what the other two are doing? Because it strikes me that if the EFL had been successful in imposing those rules on Leicester, would the Premier League then maybe have backed off a little bit? So
possibly, but given that relations between the Premier League and the EFL are pretty much Kramer versus Kramer at present with regards to the distribution, it could be that there's back channels. It could be that there's beefs at executive level and an operational level. You know, there's more cooperation. So that was that particular issue. And then at 13 minutes past four, so, you know, 13 minutes after the club had been told that you are subject to a transfer embargo, Leicester City announced that they were going to bring charges against both the Premier League and the EFL. Now, I've been in contact with some journalists sort of in the last 24 hours. They think that Nick DeMarco, who acted on behalf of Leicester City in respect of their initial charges against the EFL, they think Nick will be acting on behalf of Leicester in respect of these particular issues. He's just come off. I don't think he's getting a lot of downtime at present, is our Nick. But it looks like he's going to be acting on behalf of Leicester. And I did speak to one of our legal friends, and he's prepared to give me some names. So Tom Murray, and I know Tom very well. Tom's a really good lad. He said, we're going to potentially end up with four sets of proceedings, two of which will come under the Premier League handbook and two of which will be guided by the EFL handbook. It looks like they're going to be called arbitral proceedings. And what happens is that there'll be a panel of three people who will need to be appointed. Then there'll be a chair who's got 14 days to effectively set the terms of reference and decide how the evidence will be committed. But it could take up to 6 months for a resolution to this. And Tom's also said, whilst these proceedings are separate to the charges brought against Leicester for allegedly breaching the PNS rules, they are intrinsically linked and would therefore need to be considered in tandem, albeit under separate processes. So there could be a sort of a consolidation because we've got what he describes as an overlapping factual matrix. Now, you know, the last time I ever saw anything like a tandem was when I used to watch The Goodies. So, you know, it's going to be complicated. It could be time consuming. And once again, if we've been saying so often recently, it's a huge distraction from what should be an exciting end to the season on the pitch. Now, I think the one thing that we can say with a reasonable degree of certainty is that there won't be a points deduction against Leicester City for this season, because the EFL have said that you're subject to a transfer embargo, and presumably this case is going to take so long that you wouldn't be able to make a decision by the end of the season. So therefore, if you are the side that finishes, yeah, let's say that Leicester finish first or second in the Championship and are promoted, the side finishing third would potentially feel aggrieved. It's a mess.
It raises all sorts of questions, Kieran, about the timing of these charges by both. I mean, you can understand the Premier League saying to Leicester, look, quietly even, that, you know, you do realise when you get back into the Premier League, you may be facing charges. But to charge them now for the last period they're in the Premier League and to pretty much say in public, you'll be getting a points deduction the next time you're in the Premier League, which you then wonder then whether they're going to be motivated to even get promoted. But if they do get promoted, it seems they won't be able to buy players unless this transfer embargo by the EFL isn't imposed by the Premier League as well. So if they do get promoted, can they buy players?
Well, this is a really intriguing one, and that's a brilliant question, because what we have seen historically is, ironically, Leicester were found guilty of a breach of financial rules when they were promoted in 2014. Similarly, the same happened to Fulham and Bournemouth. And on each occasion, because the clubs were no longer in the Championship and therefore no longer under effectively the jurisdiction of the EFL, the Premier League has said, we will not accept a points deduction being given in the Championship being applied to the Premier League. But what we will do is that if instead you put through a financial penalty, we will deal with that financial penalty by deducting that money from the TV payouts from Sky, and we will transfer that money across to the EFL. So it's a degree of cooperation, and I think that does make a certain degree of sense, because you've got a Championship in which you've got 46 games and you've got a Premier League in which you've got 38. So 6 points in the Championship is a lesser penalty than 6 points in the Premier League, because you think about the maximum number of points you could achieve in a season. So you can see the logic behind that. And you know, those issues were dealt with in a different time. You know, time before, certainly when we started working together, but you know, football finance never used to be an issue, and it never used to have the degree of, I think, scrutiny and the degree of attention that we have at present times.
Well, and of course, the timing of this one again plays into the hands of the conspiracy theorists who say the Premier League are trying to look tough before the regulator comes in. But I want to talk about Leicester's response, Kieran, because I don't know if Nick DeMarco was involved in that press release yesterday about the legal action, but it was a pretty punchy statement. And I was intrigued by one line in particular. I was intrigued by several things, which I'll come on to, but the thing that caught my eye initially was that we want this to happen in public, but we've been told that it has to be behind closed doors, so we can't reveal the full truth of our defence, so to speak, which I thought was a very challenging statement to both the Premier League and the EFL.
Yes, and I can see it from Leicester's point of view. There are many stakeholders involved in a football club, but I think you and I are certainly of the view that the fans are a stakeholder who have a huge emotional investment. We should therefore have access to what is happening with regards to our clubs. You are allowed to attend a court hearing in relation to something which is happening to somebody potentially close to you. And I may have had to do that myself historically. And you behave yourself in court. Well, exactly the same would happen under these hearings, you know, because you would be aware of the expectations of you. So for those people who sneer at us as football fans as, you know, uncouth louts that can't behave ourselves, I think that's completely misdirected. I think also, as the evidence is heard, you know, people should be able to report on proceedings, unless there is, you know, we're not talking about a very offensive act against an individual person where you can understand why there could be a degree of scrutiny which is not needed, you know, not in the public domain. This is a financial issue, and therefore surely you know, journalists, fans, people who do care about the direction at which the game is heading should be entitled to observe proceedings. And if anything, that could help to reinforce faith in the way that these tribunals take place, because what is seen by some fans as significant inconsistencies with regards to what we saw with Everton. Yeah, if you go back to the Everton original case, the Premier League said it should be 6 points plus four so plus 1 point for every 5 million. So therefore, they had a 10-point deduction. And yet the Premier League said that Forest should have an 8-point deduction. But applying the Premier League's own rules, 35 million overspend is 7 plus 6. Why was the Premier League saying we only want an 8-point deduction, where under their previous statements it should be 13? And the fact that these questions are not being answered does not help, because social media can be a cesspit at times, and we're both aware of that. But it does it does sort of feed in to this sense of confusion and sense of some theories which are not necessarily grounded in fact, but sometimes you find it difficult to argue against them due to what we're seeing coming out of different appeals and different arbitrations.
The Everton and Forest panels were held in, I won't say secret because that sounds very Russian, but they were held in private, and then the findings were made public. That Forest statement, Leicester statement yesterday, seemed to me to be implying that we want to see your working out, and we want the public to see your working out, because we don't trust what you're talking about. When you say thank you very much, Leicester, we've listened to what you have to say, and we have to leave. They're saying we want the world to know what you're discussing when we go, which I can kind of understand it, but I can also, from the EFL and the PL point of view, I'd be pretty narked about that. There's a couple of things as well. They also used in their statement the Forest defence. They said that these rules are stifling ambition. Now, leave aside for a moment whether or not the rules are doing that, in the same way that you might say that driving at 20 miles an hour, I shouldn't be restricted to driving at 20 miles an hour, I'm going to drive at 30. The fact is, you are restricted to driving at 20 miles an hour, and the sign tells you that. So leaving that aside, whether the rules are right or not, it seems a bit odd for a team that won the Premier League in 2016 to say that their ambitions are being stifled. Unless, have the rules changed since Leicester won the league in 2016? And if they have, then surely Leicester would have been part of that rule change because they were in the Premier League. So they would have voted for or against it, wouldn't they?
There have been no rule changes with regards to the limits of PSR since 2013, since they were introduced in their present form. What Leicester achieved in 2016 was fantastic, but they did that because I think we all know that the stars aligned for them that season. They recruited superbly. They had relatively few injuries. They were quite similar. You and I both remember the year when Aston Villa won the old First Division, and they had 14 players on the pitch throughout the whole of the season. It just worked superbly for them. You cannot punch above your weight consistently, but Leicester have done spectacularly well. They've been very unfortunate to get back in the Champions League. And part of the reason for that is that on a proportionate basis, they are struggling against the Elite Six, the Super League Six, the Sneaky Six. And therefore, they feel, as do the owners of Newcastle, as do the owners of Aston Villa, as do the owners of Everton, as do the owners of Nottingham Forest, they feel that if you have an owner who is willing to financially underwrite losses because a club does not have a same global presence as the Elite Six, and nobody's criticising what Manchester United and Liverpool and Chelsea and Manchester City, of all those clubs, have done, absolutely fantastic. But why should they be entitled to have a wage bill which is twice, 2.5 times that of a club such as Leicester City? So I think that's Leicester's beef. Did they vote for those rules? Yes, they did. What has changed since 2016? Well, this has changed since 2016. The way that the Premier League distributes money has been geared, following Leicester's victory, to giving more money to the Big Six. It used to be that the international rights for the Premier League were split evenly between the 20 clubs. And the reason for this is that when the Premier League was set up, it didn't make any money from international rights. So therefore, 1/20th of nothing is nothing. And in fact, some years, the Premier League actually lost money from the international rights. So you can understand why the big clubs weren't bothered. As the Premier League has grown in popularity, and again, nobody's denying that the main drivers of this have been a select few of clubs, the argument put forward by the likes of the Glazers and John Henry is, why should we just take 1/20th of the money when we've got more than 1/20th of the global fan base? Because you're making money from kit sales, because you're making money from pre-season, and also because it creates a more competitive Premier League. So what happened in 2016 was that the Big Six went to the other clubs and said, unless you give us a bigger share of the international TV rights, we will go off and form a Super League. And they've used this as a bargaining chip. They've used this as a threat against the likes of Leicester, Villa, Palace, Brighton, and so on. And the other clubs caved in because there was this genuine fear prior to the Super League debacle that it was going to manifest itself. So that's been the main change, which has accelerated the gap between those Big Six clubs and the likes of Leicester. You know, you and I can both remember in recent seasons when Leicester have been third or fourth with about six or seven matches to go, and then they've tended to have a poor end to the season. Well, that's a function of the fact that you can't afford to run such a big squad as those clubs above you because they've got such an advantage in terms of the cost of their squad and the cost of their wage bill, which allows them to invest in more players.
Before I ask the next question, Kieran, I'm going to channel my inner father-in-law here, God rest his soul, who was the pedant's pedant, who would like me to point out that at no stage did Aston Villa have 14 players on the pitch. Yes. As you clearly implied, they chose from a squad of 14.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Two things to finish, Kieran. What's the amount that the Premier League are charging Leicester with overspending compared to Forest and Everton? And off the back of that question, if that was the only issue, if the only issue was that the Premier League are charging Leicester with breaching the rules in the same way that Forest and Everton were charged, what would you see their likely points deduction being in comparison to those other two?
Right. Now, here, I think Leicester, I absolutely understand them saying, we want transparency, we want the hearings to be heard in public. Leicester haven't published their accounts.
Ah.
So here, I can say, well, look, you're not helping yourselves very much. We can do the sums. Other people can do the sums as well. So we only found out the quantum of excess over the PSR limit in both the Forest and the Everton case at the end of the hearings when the Commission's reports were publicised. On the basis of what we've seen in respect of Nottingham Forest, which is the most recent and therefore one would presume would set the appropriate precedent, it's going to be a minimum of 3 points plus an additional sum in respect of just how far above the limit they've gone. One would imagine, given the sense of indignation and anger which has come from the Leicester press release and the fact that they are starting charges against the Premier League and the EFL, that I wouldn't be confident of anything being knocked off for cooperation stroke mitigation.
Well, also then, would the fact that they've not published their accounts, would that also count against them in terms of cooperation and mitigation?
No, because they will have submitted their accounts to the EFL. You know, I'm assuming that they have been submitted to the EFL by the 1st of March. Now, you know, wearing a slightly different hat, we don't have access to the inner workings of club accounts, but there is somebody within the fan base of every club, and let's be honest, there's also myself, like Swiss Ramble, and so on, who do look at the numbers and who can, I think, give a broad and objective and a non-partisan indication as to where we would roughly be in terms of overgoing the limits. Why can't the clubs, if they have to go and submit accounts to the Premier League by the 31st of December, well, why can't, as part of the licence rule, which would come out from the independent regulator, say, if you want to keep your licence, given that your biggest stakeholder group is that of the fans, why should you not publish your accounts by the 31st of December into the public domain? That you're prepared to send them privately to the Premier League by the 31st of December. So therefore, surely you can do the same for the fans. Because remember, you're asking fans to renew their season tickets in February, March and April. And if you're not prepared to publish your accounts, you're effectively saying, we expect you as fans to go and take that investment decision, because it is an investment, it's a financial commitment, on trust. Well, you can do it slightly better than that. You can do it A, on trust, and B, on the fact that we will publish you the information as well.
Mm. So to close this news story, Kieran, you know, there will be Leicester fans and probably fans of other clubs who have sympathy for Leicester who will be absolutely furious. There will be fans around the rest of the country saying, bang to rights, you've been caught, we haven't broken those rules, you know, you're going to get punished. But whatever view you take, essentially Leicester fans are sitting at home knowing that if they do get promoted, the first 6 months, possibly 8 months of the season, they're going to be a time of great uncertainty, because they're going to have this hanging over their head for that length of time. And that's not right. I understand why the Premier League is suddenly saying that these are the rules, you've broken the rules, this is what happens. I also understand those clubs saying, well, hang on a second, this rule breaking has been going on for years and you've done nothing about it. But it's not a good look, is it, for the rest, you know. It's not going to affect the way the Premier League is seen around the world. It won't affect broadcasting deals. But for those of us who love the English football game, it's not a happy time, is it?
Absolutely. And you rightly said it creates uncertainty. Waiting for a VAR decision for 3 minutes is too long. Yeah. Having to expect to wait 6 months for 3 points or 6 points or whatever it's going to be is equally frustrating. And you can understand why fans are getting fed. Yeah, we are being asked to go and pay more and more money to commit to all parts of the game, which we will. We'll moan about it, but we still will. And perhaps we're getting a bit of a raw deal.
Well, thank God Mike Dean's not involved, Kieran, because we'd wait 6 months for the decision and it'd be wrong. It's question time, Kieran. And I did just say we'd come to the end of that news story, but we sort of haven't, because our first question is topical. And it seems, Kieran, we found the secret after 3 years of doing the questions pod. We've found the secret of jumping the queue for questions. And that secret is to be a celebrity. Because Max Rushton, who we all love, the TalkSport host, sent a question in straight to the top of the pile. Right. And so I imagine that Max Rushton would have been there at TalkSport Towers with Charlie Baker and Barry Glendinning going, I've got a question here. And those two have gone, well, I don't know. I'm off the clock. I'm not Googling anything. Send it to Price of Football. And Max would have gone, no, because then they'll want us to mention them on TalkSport or interview them. So. But, you know, but producer guy, old starstruck guy, this question's gone straight to the top, but it is a very good question, I have to say. And Max Rushton says, following on from the Leicester and Forest news this week, why can't PSR timings fit in with the transfer window? Is there a sensible reason why it's June or whenever it was that Forest needed to sell Brennan Johnson by?
Yeah, I think this is an intriguing question. And we actually have seen some other clubs try to address this. So at present, Nottingham Forest have a company year end of the 30th of June. Now, they could extend that by a month. So they could have extended it to the 31st of July 2023. And you do that at Companies House. Lots of companies do it. We've seen Liverpool do it. We've seen Manchester City do it. You know, so other clubs have done it historically, extend or shorten. Some clubs did it during COVID as well. And that would have given Nottingham Forest a bit more breathing space to have sold player A, or Brennan Johnson, as he's more commonly known. I think I don't think his partner calls him player A at home. But that could have allowed them to have sold the player during July. And again, looking at the commission's hearing, part of the argument, why wasn't he sold earlier in the year, was that he was changing agent and therefore, you know, that was causing complications from the player's perspective. So we have seen this from other clubs. That would be one way of dealing with it. In terms of aligning with the transfer window, you probably remember 3 or 4 seasons ago, we actually brought the transfer window in the Premier League to the start of the season. So therefore, you had to sign all of your players by the time of the first match. So that was effectively aligning it that much closer to the financial year end. And that scheme was abandoned after one season. And the reason for that, and I spoke to some chief executives, and we spoke to people in the game as well, they said is that if you've got a window, which is the 31st of August, roughly the 31st of August, that means that if you have signed a player and you've played 3 or 4 matches, you know, what happens if they do their ACL and they're out for 6 months? You know, if you are a Palace or a Brighton, then the issue that you have there is that you just spent a lot of money. Well, that means that you've got 34 more games through which you can make an adjustment. If you have to have all of your ducks in the row before the first match, you've got to budget for all 38 games with very little opportunity to change things around. So the clubs voted to change those rules. It also meant, of course, that you know the 1st of August window shutting meant that the Premier League wasn't in alignment with European clubs, which gave them an extra month of buying and selling. So there was this issue to take into consideration. The other alternative is to change the financial year end of football clubs. Now, under the rules at present, your financial year end is linked to the football season. And you've got a choice. You can either have the 31st of May or the 30th of June or the 31st of July. But regardless of that, you know, it fits into the 23-24 season. You know, because the season finishes, third week in May. So whether you have 31st of May or the 30th of June or the 31st of July, it is completely aligned to the season. If we moved the financial year end to the 31st of August, it would mean that you would have, for a club that's promoted or relegated, you would have 10 or 11 months of your accounts relating to 22-23 season, and 1 or 2 months relating to the following season. And things start to get really messy. And also the numbers start to lose any coherence because a club like Luton probably made as much money in its first month or its first 6 weeks in the Premier League as it did from the whole season for which it was in the Championship. So that, you know, from my point of view, as somebody that sort of looks at the numbers and tries to analyse the numbers to get a feeling for the impact of one season versus another, from analytical, it doesn't really pass the smell test. You could do it though, and to add further complications to that, UEFA are now assessing clubs based on a calendar year rather than a season. And why they're doing that, because from my point of view, you're going to have 6 months worth of your accounts which are unaudited. A creative person could have a lot of fun and games with that unaudited 6 months worth of numbers.
There you go, Max. I hope that answers your question. One thing I do know is that a minute in, Charlie Baker and Max Glendinning would have gone to the pub. They would have pretended to listen for a minute. No, we're out of here now. Was that rather pleasing door sound effect, Kieran? Was that Findlay going out or the Baroness coming in to check?
No. Because the sun is shining in my office in which we're recording, Findlay has spotted that, and therefore he's opened the door and he is now sat just at my feet where the sun is coming through the window because he is a sun worshipper.
Bless him. See, he doesn't know you're going away for the weekend, does he? Yeah, if he wouldn't be so happy lying there if he knew that Daddy was going away for the weekend.
Oh, right. No. The dog sitter's coming over and she spoils him rotten. Oh. So.
Right, Kieran, let's move on to questions from our non-celebrity listeners, although I do have to point out that all our listeners are stars to us. And the first one comes from Kieran Fullop. I'm pretty sure this is a club we've never spoken about before, Kieran. And Kieran says, last year, my local club, Chorley FC of the National League North, was purchased by a gentleman named Prince Yemo. Chorley were a club run on a tight budget, playing in a fairly dilapidated ground. But Mr. Yemo issued a press release detailing his intention to invest in staff, structures and facilities of the club. So far, so good. However, probably as a consequence of listening to the show, my cynicism levels are high. I don't know why, Kieran, because we're not cynical.
We're not cynics.
And Kieran says that some cursory checks of Mr. Yemo give me concern. He has no affiliation to the town, and nor is there any evidence of any previous interest in football. Should I be worried, and is the fit and proper person test only applied to league clubs?
I'll answer your second question first, Kieran. There is no equivalent of the fit and proper test as such in the National League, which is why there have been a series of scamps and miscreants buying clubs in very recent years. I don't want to say this, but I think, Kieran, I think your spidey senses have been tingling for reasons which mine might have done the same if I was a Chorley FC fan. If we take a look at their 2022 accounts, which have been lodged at Companies House, the club lost well over £200,000 that season. And those losses were effectively underwritten, as is the case for many, many clubs under such circumstances with director loans and related party investment. So far, so good. Looking at the accounts, again, the cynic in me would say, the accounts look pretty awful. The club is technically insolvent, but technically insolvent isn't necessarily a big issue, provided you've got owners. Chelsea were technically insolvent to a certain extent, but they had Roman Abramovich. So losing money isn't necessarily the issue. It's how are you going to fund those losses? And we then come to Prince Yemo. Now, The Chorley setup is complicated. And I'm thinking, well, for a club in the sixth tier of English football, why do you need a complicated setup? So you've got Chorley Football Club Limited, and then that is controlled by a company called Chorley Sporting Club Limited. Well, that's okay to have one parent company. But then the new owner came in with a company called Reset Events Limited. And Reset Events didn't seem to have a lot in terms of its accounts. It was set up very recently. So I've been on Companies House, and Reset Events was dormant in 2022. So, is it just an off-the-shelf company? And you can buy a company. You can set up a company for £100. So just having a corporate structure doesn't mean anything. So it was dormant, and then and the timing of this question is why I'm just a little bit twitchy. 4 days ago, Prince Yemo ceased to be a director, and he was replaced by 10 different companies. And that just made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. You know, when he bought the club, there was local press releases and so, and he said, you know, we're going to create a buzz about Chorley. Fantastic. I'm high-fiving you. You know, if that's what you're genuinely going to do. I then went on to Companies House to do some more background about the owner. And the only other place I could find reference to him was a company called Future Capital Investments PLC. But that company was set up in September 2023. So we've got no accounts for that because it's not been in existence for a year. There's just a sense of we're not looking great. Now, I've got zero evidence, and we're going to make zero accusations with regards to the owner, because that would be completely inappropriate. But why has he resigned his position at Reset Events? Why have all of these companies come in, which are now appear to be buying owning a slice of Reset Events? None of that makes you feel particularly at ease. You know, and we've been talking with regards to transparency. I think transparency is absolutely critical. You know, we often say that sunshine is the greatest disinfectant. And certainly from a corporate point of view, and as somebody that comes from an old finance background, shining a light on things is useful. When you shine the light and you're not quite sure what you're seeing in return, you start to become a little bit less comfortable.
Mm. Some of us hate sunshine, remember, Kieran, disinfectant or otherwise. So just to clarify, Kieran, he resigned as a director of a dormant company and was replaced by 10 other named individuals or companies?
Well, no, these were companies. Now, I'm trying to get to the bottom of what all companies with which themselves don't seem to be doing very much. So why go through this process? And you know, if anybody in the club is listening, you know, right of reply, we're entirely, you know, we believe in transparency ourselves.
Absolutely.
So if we could have clarification, we would appreciate it. But yeah, we wish Chorley FC. You know, so I used to play in Lancashire League cricket and so on. So I'm familiar with Chorley, but I'm not feeling great. Which isn't the same as feeling bad.
Yeah, of course. And although it strikes me from past experience that this is the very first of the flags, it seems to me that Chorley will be coming back in the news pod in the next few weeks or so. I pray to God they don't. But just very briefly, Kieran, I'm assuming dormant simply means no money in, no money out.
Yeah, no transactions in the year. So that was for 2022 accounts. Yeah, we'll wait to see if there's been an activity in 2023.
As I said earlier, Kieran, we will on Thursday be talking about the economics of the England kit. We won't get involved in this ludicrous debate about the purple cross on the back of the shirt, but the economics, I'm not emotional at all about the cross on the back of the shirt. The cost of the bugger, I'm very emotional about. But Matt Greenwood has a question about kits. And Matt says, on the final day of the season, I've always wondered why some clubs wear the following season's kit. Is there a financial benefit or reason for this? I guess, Kieran, it's just a bit of PR and advertising, is it?
Yes, there will be a lot driving that. If it's, you know, a noticeable change, and also to a certain extent, we have seen it at cup finals.
Yeah,
and that can be really great, because if the club announces the new kit a week before the cup final, you can have a huge surge in sales. So there is a potential financial boost. Putting on our PSR hat, if you have a kit launch before the 30th of June, that brings in extra money for the club. which, you know, if you are close to the limit, could be beneficial. So, so there are these. There will be other considerations. You know, I'm aware of, I wouldn't even say top six. I would say, you know, top two or three club, where the kit manufacturers have said, we're not going to supply you with any more kit this season. You know, because we've got other things to do. And therefore, you know, when you go into the superstore, so if you've effectively sold all of your kit with two or three matches to go, why not launch the new kit for the last home match of the season and again get that uptick in respect of sales? Because you've got the advantage. You know, you and I both know that, you know, if you wait long enough, this season's kit, it will be at 30% off or 50% off or whatever. But if you've managed to sell all of the deliveries, then why not take on next season's kit? Because you'll be selling that at full price. You're not having to discount the old season kit. So there are those benefits. You have to have continuity here with regards to things such as sponsors. So if you're ending your sponsorship deal, then that sponsorship deal will finish on the 30th of June. What you can't do is to be seen to be having a new sponsor for the old season, because that would be a breach of contract and so on. So there are some complications, but if you've got continuity of sponsor, continuity of manufacturer, then just go ahead with it. If the kit has been manufactured, yeah, there's that. You know, there are sort of supply chain issues to take into consideration as well.
This is a good one, Kieran. All our questions are good, obviously, but this is a particularly good one from Mark Ridley. Mark says, last season I attended Maidenhead versus Wrexham in the National League. There are an additional 2,000 fans to what the club would get for an average National League fixture, which would presumably have brought in an extra £40,000 to £50,000 revenue. And I'm guessing this probably would have been replicated for many of Wrexham's away games. But with Celtic and Rangers B teams, both in the Scottish Lowland League, has their presence provided additional income for other teams in that league in a similar fashion?
I think this is indicative of the size of the pile, because Rangers have withdrawn from the Lowland B League for season 23-24. So when Mark wrote the question, which was an absolute cracker, what we do now have, I think Hearts B team has come in. But I think the broad tenure of the question is absolutely a valid one. When Celtic and Rangers B team started off in the Scottish Lowland League, there was an uptick in terms of attendance, which was mainly driven by a curiosity factor. You know, people wanted to see, you know, were we going to see, you know, some Rangers and Celtic stars who were perhaps trying to get rehabilitate themselves following injury and so on. But that initial uptick with regards to attendances tapered off quite quickly. So we now still have Celtic B in the Lowland League. I think they're presently sixth and Hearts are presently second. So they're not walking away with the league. So this, I think, was part of the fear. Rangers, by all accounts, pulled out of the National League because they felt that it should be that there should be a fifth tier of Scottish football, which would allow for, you know, some form of acceleration between the leagues with a natural ceiling, of course, as happens in Spain and some other places. I don't think that was voted through. I like the Lone League because it's one of those. First of all, it's got the civil service strollers, which I think is a fantastic name. Yeah. It's got a couple of universities as well. So it sounds absolutely intriguing. Quite often we're looking at club attendances in, you know, in the very low hundreds. And those attendances are not being boosted in 23-24 by the existence of the Edinburgh and Glasgow B teams.
Scottish football is way ahead of us in terms of names. I mean, English football has got some beautiful, like Aston Villa, Crystal Palace, of course, but for the most part, Scottish football team names just make you go, as a kid, you go, I wonder what that place is like. Bonnyrigg Rose, what a fantastic name. Our next question, Kieran, It comes from Luke Judson, and it's one of those questions that I would say every week I love the most, because it's a very simple question, and it's one of those that you think, why haven't I asked that before? And I'm really intrigued to know what the answer to this question is, Kieran. And Luke's question is this: what do huge companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola, for example, get out of sponsoring football clubs or football events? It's not like they're trying to get their brand out there, because everyone knows their brands already. I think that's a cracking question, Kieran, because these hugely well-known global brands are spending a lot of money to put their name to something when we all know about the product anyway.
Yes. If you talk to people in marketing, they will tell you that 50% of a big corporation's marketing budget is wasted. The problem is they don't know which 50% is wasted.
Ha!
So, you know, is it adverts on the radio? Is it television? Because you cannot link an individual campaign to
Postman?
Yes. Amazon, I think the looks of it.
It's like living in a 1970s comic in your house, isn't it? You've got the only dog left in the country that barks at the postman. You've got the only... I imagine your postman wears a cap.
He actually wears... Our Kevin wears shorts every day of the year.
Does he?
He's absolutely brilliant. Yes, yeah.
Well,
but you see, the reason why it's a 1970s sitcom is Finley is an English setter. He's not a woke dog.
Ah.
A woke dog wouldn't bark at the postman, would he?
No, good for you. No, a woke dog would welcome the postman in. Good for you. I don't blame Kevin for not wearing long trousers, because Finley's got nothing to grab hold of then, has he?
Yeah, so back to Luke's question. The likes of Coca-Cola and McDonald's, now they don't tend to sponsor football clubs, and there's a reason for that. If they were sponsoring Brighton, you would never buy Coca-Cola, would you? You'd never go to McDonald's.
No, that's true.
So therefore, they're aware of the tribal nature of being associated with individual clubs. And from a global point of view, that makes them a bit reluctant. What they are very keen to do, however, is to say, how can we guarantee that our brand will be seen by as many eyeballs as possible, especially at times when people will be either consuming food and beverages or thinking of consuming food and beverages, which is, of course, yeah, if you're watching the World Cup, if you're watching the Euros and so on. So therefore, they tend to be the senior partners of these competitions on that basis. Because global brands want a global audience, and therefore for a global audience, you want a global event. And there is nothing more global than the FIFA World Cup. We then come to the issue of the nature of their products. And there is, I think we've now reached the stage where we know that there is no such thing as a pure product. Coca-Cola and McDonald's are unhealthy products. Yeah, you know, it is unhealthy food. It is, anybody that looks at the world or talks to nutritionists, you know, say, you know, the part of the reason for the decline in average life attendances, you know, we've seen that in the United States, we've seen that now start to appear here in the UK, is due to the increase in high fat, sugar, and salt products. Well, Coca-Cola and McDonald's, you know, high-fiving themselves with HFSS products. So there's an element here of sports washing. What you're trying to do is to associate in a subliminal way an unhealthy product with a healthy activity, which is, you know, watching elite athletes perform their skills. You will not see the England team or the Brazil team tucking into a happy meal, will you? Because, you know, it goes against the grain. They are monitored on a practically a daily basis with regards to their inputs, with regards to food and sugar and so on, because their health and fat levels are carefully checked, because they are elite athletes. So this is a way of associating a brand for an unhealthy product with an activity which is deemed to be desirable, which is playing sport, you know, healthy activities and so on.
You're absolutely right about the club sponsorship, Kieran, because if I was eligible for an American Express card, I would turn it down. I would absolutely refuse. Luckily, it's not an issue. And also, just to keep our lawyer happy, I'm going to suggest the occasional can of Coke and the occasional Big Mac, fine. Just not for a day, basically. Nothing wrong with the occasional Big Mac. Our next question, Kieran, comes from Michael Yerachi. And the reason I'm so confident in the pronunciation of Michael Yerachi's name is that Michael, God love him, finally has put in brackets the way to pronounce his name. Because otherwise, we'd have been here for minutes when I went through a whole range of So would it kill the rest of you just occasionally to put a little pronunciation guide? Thank you. Michael Yerachi's question is, of course, a good one. Michael lives in Australia, and he says, here in Australia, there's a News Corp-owned streaming service known as KO Sports. Michael's also, in brackets, told me how to pronounce KO, which I think I probably would have been able to guess that one, Michael. Thank you very much. But KO Sports, pronounced KO, which centralises all of the main pay TV sports channels onto one subscription for the price of $25 per month. The only comparable services in the UK are online subscriptions for Sky Sports via Now TV and BT Sport, now TNT Sport, of course, which cost £35 and £25 respectively per month. Based on relative earnings, would a similar product work in the UK at a monthly subscription fee of £15? Or would this struggle to turn a profit as the inflated rights model relies heavily on football being a loss leader for other content and services on Sky and BT?
Well, this is a fantastic question, Mike. I think you are right in your summation there, in the sense that Sky and TNT pay a huge sum of money for the rights to broadcast the Premier League. That effectively attracts people in. It's the stickiness that it creates with return to not just getting subscriptions, but people renewing their subscriptions. And therefore, the money that they pay to the Premier League has to be recovered in some way. Everybody would love a £15 a month subscription. That's not going to happen. This is going to create problems because, you know, a lot of people are saying that the price is charged, you know, that they are considerably more. You know, £15 a month is still more than you're paying for your TV license, for example. £35 and £25 a month is more than double. And here we have this issue in terms of pricing of products. It drives people towards alternative markets. And, you know, we have said on many occasion that we all know somebody down the pub called Big Dave who can get you a Fire Stick, and we are not... that is illegal, but it is seen by some people as a victimless crime. With regards to the topic we're going to come to on Thursday, I was sent by one of my mates called Big Dave. He's got the New England shirt, £12.89.
Ha! Okay. It's a very specific price.
Very, very specific price. Yeah, £12.89. I'm going, well, you can see why people are attracted to that. If they aren't, and nobody's saying, well, we want to encourage the use of sweatshops, the potential money flowing to unscrupulous individuals. But when the differential is so big, people on a budget, people knowing that England will probably wear the away shirt perhaps four times before it gets replaced in 12 months' time, you can see why people go down that route. So, unfortunately, Sky, I think Sky and to a certain extent TNT, it is a fantastic product, but it is an expensive product. And they would lose money at £15 a month, or rather they would lose even more money. I think they probably actually do lose money with regards to the current pricing scheme. But it does attract people to buy more products from Now TV or Sky themselves to allow Sky to make an overall profit.
You see, this is my issue with that England shirt, Kieran, because the FA could sell it for £12.89 and they'd still make a bloody profit. So imagine how much more profit they're making at selling it £125, which is why we're going to deal with this on Thursday. Get one for me next time you see Big Dave, will you? I'll I'll give it to Ed for Christmas. We're getting on for an hour, Kieran. We still have three questions left, but they're very good questions, Kieran. So as long as you're happy to stay for 10 more minutes, I'm happy to stay for 10 more minutes. It just means that all of our super fit listeners who apparently listen to us in the gym just have to have an extra 10 minutes in the gym. So that'd be good for them as well. It's amazing, Kieran, isn't it? How many we do the live gigs and you think none of these people look like they listen to this pod in the gym. Neither the two people presenting it don't look like they listen to it in the gym. Walking the dog, I agree. The first question, Kieran, and I'll tell you at the end of this why I'm really interested in the answer. It comes from Roberto Petrucco. And Roberto says, with Sevilla winning the Europa League with Jesus Navas in the team, it got me thinking about when he signed for Manchester City. The same summer, his brother Marco Navas signed for Bury. What a huge coincidence, says Roberto in brackets. It was rumoured that Jesus Navas was homesick. Do you see where this is going? Says Roberto in brackets. Yes. Is there anything to stop an agreement between two clubs doing a deal like this? And did anything ever come up about money being passed between the clubs around the time of the deal? The reason I'm intrigued by the answer, Kieran, is that not long after Palace signed Christian Benteke, we also signed his brother, Jonathan, who I believe played for about 25 minutes in a Carabao Cup game. And it was basically, he looked like he was on some kind of make-a-wish thing. So we all know that we signed him to keep Christian happy and have some family around him. Well, that's the theory. So I'm interested in the answer to this one, Kieran.
Well, first of all, with regards to Jesus Navas, I think his condition is something which gets completely overlooked in terms of the way that we view footballers. He was unable to go out of his house at one point in time. He was suffering panic attacks. Yeah, he was unfamiliar with his surroundings when he came to the UK. And we are dealing with young men who are being taken out of their network, out of their family, out of the place that they feel secure, and being dumped elsewhere. And that can have a negative impact on them. So therefore, having family around, I think, is important. We are seeing more and more clubs providing that level of assistance, you know, either through paying for flights for loved ones to come across, sorting out sort of, you know, mini communities within the club itself. If you've got two or three South American players, we make sure that, you know, when they first join the club, that works. I'm aware of one very high profile Premier League club where they just signed two Brazilian players, and neither of whom spoke English, and therefore, you know, they'd signed, they're looking around, yeah, absolutely huge club we're talking about, they're going on their pre-season tour, they just signed before the pre-season tour, and they were in business class because they were flying to the United States, and you only get around about six or eight first class seats on a transatlantic flight. There was another high profile player who spoke Portuguese, and I think we can probably guess who we're talking about, who was asked, he was, because he was a star at that particular club, was asked to pop downstairs and just familiarize and just be friendly and chat to the players and introduce them to some of their new colleagues, because clearly there's a language barrier. He could act as an interpreter because he was bilingual, of course. And he turned to the manager, who was, again, very high profile and very successful manager, and says, I don't travel business class. I don't talk to people in business class. Sort it out yourself. So that's another story. But with regards to this, familiarisation and acclimatisation are absolutely critical. If you're buying an asset for 20 to 30 million pounds, then you want it to be working and firing on all cylinders. So we do see this type of things. Now, with regards to where Roberto was making hints, I've no idea if there was an arrangement between the two clubs. As far as I'm aware, it's not on 115 charges from Manchester City, so there's no evidence of things like this taking place. can there be some, is, are there lines of communication between clubs? Yes, there are. And, you know, can you come across and train with one of the other clubs? You know, there's various things that can be done. But actually, it's not actually during the working day. I think the panic attacks and the feeling of, you know, somebody that's spent an awful lot of time working overseas on in practically every continent, and I've been very lucky in what I've done, you do feel somewhat isolated, and having a friendly face can make a difference, especially if that friendly face is family or someone that you're fully aware of and so on.
Or if that friendly face is a beautiful Russian lady, even. Do you know what, Kieran? You're getting so woke, really. I mean, what's it come to that if a 19-year-old professional footballer can't come to this country from somewhere a long way away and sit rocking on his own in a hotel room, missing his family, just he's got to suck it up, Kieran. What's the matter with you? Our penultimate question, Kieran, comes from Phil Reynolds, and this the first sentence of this question. I don't know whether I should be proud that you've inspired someone to do this, or whether I should, whether it's the saddest first sentence of any question I've ever read. I'm going to go for the first one, Kieran, that you've inspired Phil Reynolds. Because Phil Reynolds says, Phil Reynolds says, I'm attempting to be Gillingham's answer to Kieran and analyse the accounts on Twitter for our fan base each year. And if you want to see Phil's analysis, you can go to @beanhead1411, he tells us. But, says Phil, our 2022 accounts have somewhat stumped me. We are now showing we have more than 200 staff employed, which is more than double that of the year before, yet our staff costs only increased by 300,000. So that doesn't stack up to me. We've never had that many employees on the books, and that seems to work out to an average of 17,000 per employee. Do you have any words of wisdom on what this could be, other than error, or is it perhaps zero-hour contracts?
I think it's more of the latter, Phil, and also congratulations for doing a fantastic job.
Yes.
Engagement is whatever industry, whatever level, I think is something which is to be applauded. I've taken a look at the Gillingham 2022 accounts, and the difference in terms of employee numbers, what Gillingham have done, which I think is good, is that they've broken down the total staff numbers into playing staff, management, and so on, marketing. And then there's a final category which says other commercial activities. And this has gone up from 38 to 161. So I suspect what has happened is that the staff that are employed on a match day basis, who perhaps were being outsourced previously, are now being employed directly by Gillingham. And whilst personally, I think that the club has probably been overcautious here, you don't count an employee as being a full-time employee unless they do a minimum of X hours per week. And I don't personally think that ground staff, sorry, match day staff would fall into this. It looks as if the club has taken an alternative view. And therefore, you know, the stewards, the turnstile operators, all of the people that make our life that much better on a match day are now being included in your total staff numbers, whereas previously that wouldn't have been the case.
Do you know what? I think I'm just a bit sulky, Kieran, because no one ever writes in to say I'm attempting to be Gillingham's answer to Kevin and try and make half-hearted attempts to amuse people in a pub and say, I don't know, ask Kieran. Basically, our final question comes from Dean Gallagher, and again, this is another of those cracking questions that I've never thought about before, but should have done. And Dean's question is this: it's often said that the Championship playoff final is the most valuable game in football and a cash bonanza for the promoted team. But can you identify the team that has been most adversely affected financially following relegation from the Premier League?
Yes, I've taken a look at this one, and I'm just wondering whether this Dean Gallagher is the same Dean Gallagher that I used to play alongside as centre half for a team called the Blackadders in the mid 80s. We dynamic duo. I was the lanky twat who do all the heading, and Dean was sort of the Bobby Moore stylish ability to nip the ball off the toes off the centre forward and bring it forward majestically. With regards to this, I've taken a look at all of the clubs that have been relegated over the past 10 to 15 years, and the one that I've gone for is Aston Villa being relegated in 2016. And numbers-wise, in terms of revenue, the revenue went down by just £35 million. So not necessarily the most amount, but that is sort of two or three iterations of the TV deal. But I think there's other ways that we can measure financial effect. And the reason and the thing which really hit me with regards to Villa is that following relegation from the Premier League to the Championship, their employee numbers, and this sort of ties in with what we've just been talking about with Phil, went in the reverse direction. And the number of staff employed decreased by 560. Wow. And this is something we have spoken about as the hidden cost of relegation. Fans are crying, players are, they're facing wage cuts, but they've still got a job. You're going from 40 grand a week to 30 grand a week under your relegation clause. So there was that. It was at the time of Tony Gee, who was an owner, was himself had some financial issues. The highest paid director's pay went down from £3 million in the last season in the Premier League to 350 grand in the first season of the Championship. Again, still a sum of money, which 99.9% of people, I would imagine, would be absolutely delighted to receive. But that was the one. And also with regard to that is that Aston Villa nearly went into liquidation. I'm saying not just administration. They were the club that I've seen, the most high profile club I've ever seen get that close to liquidation.
Mm. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page, including a very happy Tim Onions, who says, "I'm excited to become a Price of Football Ultra to celebrate the Spireites' return to the world of FFP and amortization. It's easier to leave the 92 than to return. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod and get access to our chat community and our regular quizzes, that'd be very kind of you. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, you can email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And you can go to the same website if you want to buy our book or one of our T-shirts. Kieran's off to Brussels. We'll be back on Thursday with our latest news pod, most of which will be me tearing my hair out about that fucking England shirt. In the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thank you to everybody. Thank you to the people that support us on Patreon. We do appreciate it. We acknowledge just as much as everybody else. Times are tough, so it is very kind. We will be setting up an end of season quiz. We're not that far away now. So there are a variety of ways in which you can engage with the show, one of which is to give us a review. It certainly does help. Doesn't matter what you say. You can even say you would rather have the show presented by people on the fast lane of the Price of Football. So therefore, Max Rushton and Philip Schofield, they both used the fast lane in different ways, of course.
Very good. It's like being back in the I Got News for You. That's Max. Actually, again, that's two in a row that I'd listen to, Max Rushton and Philip Schofield. I mean, he'd be more cheerful than Barry Glendinning for a start off, wouldn't he? Really, that'd be hilarious. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The Price of Football.
Picture this, the roar of a crowd, the tension building, the electrifying moment your team scores the winning goal. Pure joy, right? But for many football fans, barriers can shut them out of that experience. In the UK, nearly 1 in 4 people, that's 16 million, have a disability. And over 70% of those disabilities are non-visible.
There's a really broad range of non-visible disabilities out there. So it can be hearing loss, it can be sight loss, it can be neurodiversity, it can be any manner of things that people can't perceive.
People look, why are they parking in a blue badge space? They can walk. Why are they using an accessible toilet? They're walking in. But that's not the point. You can't see the invisibleness of the disability. But then if somebody's judging you, you can tell they haven't got the awareness. They haven't got the understanding.
I've always lived my life as a sighted person who can't see. To the point where then if I didn't have my long cane chancellor, a lot of people wouldn't know. Me having it isn't always just for me, but it is actually for other people as well.
Find out how you can contribute to a more inclusive matchday experience for everyone by supporting Level Playing Field, the national charity advocating for greater access and inclusion for all disabled sports fans through its Unite for Access campaign. Unite for your team, unite as a fan. Let's unite for access.